All right, I think that the best way to introduce our text today, looking again at 1 Corinthians 13 in this series on this love chapter, would be to kind of back up a little bit and get a feel for the theme of love developed by Paul here in the chapter as a whole. I just want to do that briefly, but kind of get the big picture and then work to where we are today. And when we do that, I think it's interesting to notice that what we have, what we have here are three basic things. The first is, in 1 to 3, what might be called the indispensability of love. Now, this outline isn't going to be hard and fast, but I like the second one is to say from 4 to 7 is the beauty of love, and then the third section is the permanence of love. Now, this may be three ways to just kind of grab on to the chapter as a whole. Now just think about that with me for a little bit. Let's kind of just meditate for a moment on this chapter and those in that way. The indispensability of love. How does Paul develop its indispensability early on? You know, he tells us that there's no human dignity without love. Now you could have the gifts and knowledge and all kinds of things, but without love, I am nothing, he says. I am. What are we? What is a human being? I am nothing without love. It's indispensable to human dignity. I'll be a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. It's indispensable to human communication, to intelligibility, to meaningful relationships, and just really intelligibility about the significance of life itself as a whole. It's indispensable to that. So that's one of the ways of focusing this. You know, he also tells us that I gain nothing without love. With all the things that someone might pursue in life, that they might be after, and what they might do, without love, all my doings, all my sacrifices, gain nothing. There's no profit. So there's no value, no significance to life, no communication, no human dignity without love. I think it's an amazing opening to this chapter. And if that isn't enough, Paul goes on to tell us about the beauty of love, we'll kind of say it, in those next verses when he talks in particular and then in general about love, in particular what love is. It has these certain characteristics. Love is patient. Love is kind. And he does some very particulars on the negative and on the positive. Those were a couple of positives. And then it's not arrogant. It's not rude. And remember, you can infer to the opposite of both of those. And so you get this list. And it's not an exhaustive list, but just a marvelous list that you can reflect on for the positives and the negatives and see the beauty of love. And then he gives us, in this section that we're coming to now, he gives us the permanence of love. And we're sort of directed in our thoughts in that way. So, you know, all this is not hard and fast. There's no inspired outline. But we're directed in that way. If you look at sort of the bookends, we'll call it in the literature here, of verse 8 and verse 13, with the notion of the abiding quality of love. When verse 8a, he says, love never ends. And when he gets to the end of the chapter, he says, love abides. These three abide. There's this abiding quality. So now you see he's on this abiding quality of love. So this last section we're calling the permanence of love. So this is a marvelous chapter, and that's the section I want to now focus on, the permanence of love. And he actually develops that in two ways. At least that's how I'm going to develop it. And the verse 13 I'm going to leave for another time. So that'll be also a part of the permanence of love. And so I'm going to concentrate on verses 8 to 12. And calling this the permanence of love. And there are two things that I want to deal with and just kind of really narrow in on this part of the passage, I guess the way to say it, just to talk about, you know, what Paul does in 8a when he says love never fails, as this is simply the statement. Here it is, the permanence of love stated. And then I want to deal with the permanence of love compared. So we just have the statement and the comparison. Those are the two things that I want to address today. Maybe another way to say this first part is the permanence of love declared. and then we'll look at its the way Paul unfolds this in a comparison. So we have declared and compared, I guess, I'm trying to get at. All right, those are the two things I want to look at today. Now, so I mean, I've given you the kind of like the outline of the whole chapter. We just talked about that a little bit. But now to focus on the outline for the message today on the permanence of love, we're going to look at those two things. It's declared, and then it's compared. So let's try to draw our attention that way. So 8a, let's begin there. Love never ends. Some of your translations will have love never fails. That's where I'm getting this declaration. And we can begin this looking at the declaration of the permanence of love by asking this question. What new element, if any, is added when Paul says this here? What new element is added to what he just said at the end of verse 7, that love endures all things? Is there any new element? If so, what is that new element? So going from, so we got to just look back a little bit more in order to go forward. He had said love endures all things. Now he says love never ends. What's the difference between that? We said that enduring, you know, abiding quality of love. Now love never ends. What's the difference? So let's just look at this a little bit and note what endure means again. Remember, we emphasized that endure does have a temporal element because it just kind of sticks to it, right? Love does not quit. It doesn't give up. What's the emphasis in 7, at the end of verse 7, when it talks like that? The emphasis in love endures is on its tenacity, its perseverance, its stick-to-itiveness, right? Love sticks to it. No matter what will be faced, and that's what I liked about how this interfaced with the other material in that the beauty of love section there. But it will not give up. No matter what must be faced for the sake of the gospel and for the sake of Christ, love will endure. It will not give up. It bears all things for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of Christ. And it believes them all. It will pursue all of the teachings of Holy Scripture. And it will do that no matter what it may bring, and no matter what would have to be born because of those teachings. And it hopes, it endures, it's tenacious, it perseveres in hope in all things, no matter what comes in life, in all the things of life, as history is moving on forward, because of the gospel, in our labor for the gospel, seeking that out first and foremost in our lives, it endures, hoping, looking with expectation and anticipation for the return of Christ. That's the endurance part. Now, what does Paul add to that? Abiding, that's across time, and it looks across all of the issues that we would have face in life with hope toward the coming of Christ. What would Paul add when he says that love never ends? And it just has to be the accent on the temporal in a most complete sense. And I think it would just be, you know, why I say most complete sense. Love endures for time and eternity. What he said about enduring has to do with, you know, he just emphasizing that tenacity, that perseverance within time, over time, with the things that we must face and bear in history, in life, on this earth, in struggling on the way. When he says love never ends, he just transcends it all. And it's something that not only abides for time, but abides for eternity. It does not end. He just accents that eternality of love. If one emphasizes the tenacity of love, all he does is just take that persevering quality, that overtime quality, and accents that and tells us that love is eternal, that it abides. And that's a welcome note. I mean, what a welcome note. There's something that abides. I mean, I think, I don't know, I hope I can even get at this passage with some value for you all. It just seems striking to me to hear that those words, love never ends. It never fails. Never. And it's a strong word. It never fails. Go beyond the grave. Go beyond your entry into the grave, my entry into the grave. Go beyond human history altogether on this earth. And what abides? Beyond history itself. Love abides. And that language is just really hard to get our arms around, you know, get our mind around, get our hands on, right? This is amazing that love never ends. I mean, that's another reason why this has to be talking about Christian love in a most ultimate sense. See what I'm saying? It has to be talking about the love of God. That's what 1 Corinthians 13 is all about. The love of God that is reflected in His creation, in His new creation especially, in those He has redeemed by His blood, in the redeemed, upon whom He sets forth His love. His love never fails, and therefore as He's working it out in His people, it will never fail, it will last through time and into eternity. It is something that is forever. It goes beyond the grave. It has to be that love of God being reflected in the lives of His redeemed. This is a transcendent love. This is an amazing love that we're talking about in this chapter. Not just a love, like we said. Anybody can read this at any wedding. Excuse me. Just any wedding, just go to the love chapter. You know. Now this is Christian love of this in this chapter. It's love of the redeemed. Love of God being reflected in the lives of His people. And so what we have, I like to think of this one more thing before I leave this portion here, but I like to think that this is a mega scale of Psalm 139. There's a phrase in Psalm 139 that just always has leaped out at me, and I've told you this before. I think this passage is sort of, for me at least right now, a mega scale of that psalm. It's not the one we read earlier, but it's just when Paul, when the psalmist says in 139, I awake, and I am still with you. I always found that striking language. It's right in the middle of, it just kind of like drops in there. The psalmist says to the Lord, now he's talking about how the Lord's knowledge is too wonderful for me and describing how we're formed in the womb and all the knowledge of God's creative order and everything. And he has this phrase and he just says in there, I awake and I am still with you. And I just think, I'll try to fill it out. I get why I see this as a mega scale of that in 1 Corinthians. Well, listen to the language. The psalmist, the direction of thought. You know, I go to sleep at night, and I wake up in the morning, and I find that I'm still with you. I am with you. I continue to be with you. Every morning I wake up in the morning, and I'm with you. And what's he saying in the big picture of that, right? This is his experience of the presence of God. I am still with you because you are there. See, that's the psalm of God's omnipresence and omniscience and everything. You are there in covenant faithfulness. I awake in the morning, and I'm with you because you stay with me in your steadfast, unfailing, eternal love for me. This passage has to be seen against that love. And that's then the call that it is to us to love, right? But it has that deep root. You have to see it. I think we have to just dig way back, that deep root of the love of God. Unfailing. Eternal love of God. It never fails. It's being reflected in us. And then we have all these qualities that we're to work at in the manifestation of love in our lives. The beauty of that love. But it's God's love that we're to reflect. Well, that's a wonderful Psalm, I think, Psalm 139, verse 18, to just think about a lot. I just love the direction of that. I wake up and I'm still with you. I am still with you. It's like I haven't left, you know. But there's no place, no way that I can go anywhere. I wake up and there you are. You surround me with your love. All right, now the permanence of love is next. Now, see, I'm just saying that's what Paul declares. I think that's a marvelous declaration. That's why I don't want to just say, well, this is a statement or something. I started to say it that way, and I want to say it in bigger terms than that. When that little phrase, love never ends, love never fails, that's a marvelous declaration about the permanence of love. Christian love, rooted God's love, God's love being reflected in the lives of people. All right, now, next what we have is Paul's comparison. Let's look at that. And, you know, in this comparison section, if you're looking at the verses in 1 Corinthians, you have some of the phrases in here that are very memorable. I know that you know about these. People know about these that aren't even Christians. About, when I was a child, I spake as a child, understood as a child, reasoned as a child. You know, that type of language. I became a man. Child to man. And the seeing through a mirror dimly. Seeing through a mirror, but then face to face. Memorable things are brought up in this passage. Some very memorable things about the comparison. So I want to deal with this section in a series of questions. The first one I'll take the most time on, then I have a couple other questions to just very briefly ask and answer. But let me take a little bit more time with this first question. What precisely is compared with love in this section? And even, I guess I'm biasing the answer by the way I'm stating the question. What precisely is compared with the unending love in verses 8b down to 12. And it's that whole unit, what's being compared. And I want to answer it by just saying like this. Although prophesying and tongue-speaking gifts are cited, mentioned in this unit, this pericope, they say, this paragraph, this unit of thought, even though they're mentioned, they're in the backdrop. It's knowledge. Knowledge is in the foreground. My claim is, I'll try to just support this as I go a little bit, the real comparison is going to be made now when Paul takes the permanence of love and compares it. He compares the permanence of love with knowledge. That's the real precise point of comparison. And let me just kind of give a few things about how this is the case. And I'd like you just to think with me under kind of this way of thinking about it. Knowledge here in verse 8, let me just read the verse and just note this. Knowledge here is the third man out. And this starts to hint in the direction where we're going. Listen to the verse. He says, love never ends, but then now you see where the comparison opens up. As for, right? As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. Well, you sound like you have a gift. You know, you have these gifts, and so you think what he's comparing is love with the gifts. Right? But if I think we can note that knowledge is the third man out. When the gifts are referred to, the gifts are the gifts that give the product of knowledge. They're the sources of knowledge. Now here are three things I just want to mention. I want to look back, look in within the verse, and look ahead, and note why knowledge is what is really being compared to love here, and not the gifts. If you look back to 12:8, there is a knowledge gift, but I'm saying knowledge is the third man out. It's not a gift here. It's not a gift. The other two, you might say, well, you have gifts, but you have this one. It's odd. It's not a gift. In 12:8, we have this, the reference to the utterance of knowledge, which is apparently a gift, the gift of knowledge. You see, it could be that. To one is given through the Spirit the utterance of wisdom, to another the utterance of knowledge. Something given by the Spirit, an utterance of knowledge, and back up in verse 4, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit who gives this utterance of wisdom, this utterance of knowledge. So I'm not sure what it is. But apparently there is a type of gift of the utterance of knowledge, called the utterance of knowledge, or as some, you've heard this in many other contexts, a word of knowledge. That's the phrase, word of knowledge. It's a gift of the word of knowledge, the word of knowledge gift. And that seems to be the case here in 12:8. But if you look at, I mean, in 12:8, but if you look in 13:8, I think there are, just to make now the contrast here, there's not enough given about the word knowledge here, the way that term is used here, to make us identify it with that gift in the first, in the earlier reference. In 12:8, he uses word of knowledge, and here there is no word of knowledge mentioned. It's just simply knowledge. Now, you'll see how this builds, how important this is in a minute. But there's just not enough information there. You say it could be the gift. But there's not enough information for us to pin it down that this is the same thing he mentioned in 12.8. Now, here's another thing. When you look at the distinctions within 13.8, so look at in chapter 13 and verse 8, when he says prophecies, tongues, and knowledge, actually, there's only one gift referred to there, if we would say it this way, one gift referred to unambiguously there, the tongue-speaking gift. Because when he says prophecies, what's that? That's not the gift of prophesying. That's mentioned in the next verse, verse 9. But here in verse 8, prophecies. What are prophecies? They're the products of the gift of prophecy. That is, that's the information, the revelation from God, the truth that is given by revelation. So he's talking about revelation, truth, knowledge in another form. Now that is knowledge that is given as prophecy, divine revelation, revelationary knowledge, as we say. So then if you have gifts referred to here, the only one that's unambiguous would be tongues. And see, the suggestion I'm making here as we go, we'll see, even tongues are being referred to in terms of what they're short for, what tongues give us. Same thing that prophecies give us. Revelation. Knowledge furnishing revelation. And he mentions knowledge then, directly. Now looking ahead, I think, is the strongest one. And now when you put those two points I've made, looking back, looking within the verse, and now look ahead, you can see that the whole accent is on knowing, on knowledge, on human knowing, on our knowing. Look at the verses as we go. Let me just note as I read down, starting with verse 9. We know in part, we prophesy in part. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then the partial will be done away. But look in verse 11. I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought, understood like a child. I reasoned, did logic like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways, for now we see in a mirror dimly, we see, I guess I'm trying to emphasize these words, we see, the word for understand, know, right? We see in a mirror dimly. Then, and you can supply, again, we see, we will see face to face. We will know and understand in a face to face way. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. I mean, I didn't accent it like I'd like to, but I think you got the point. All through this section, it has to do with knowledge, our understanding, our knowing. And so the only thing you'd ask is, well, why would even the prophesying in tongues be mentioned? And I think it's easy to see that partly is that there has been an abuse of those, and there the fact that the sources of that product of knowledge, that the source will pass away, the tongues will cease. That's important to Paul just against the backdrop of the abuses that are there at Corinth. But his attention, his whole attention, is not on those gifts. His attention is on the product of those gifts. It's on knowledge. What is being compared? Love is being compared to knowledge. Knowing. Even knowing divine revelation. Things that God gives us by the gift of other, you know, other functions like prophesying in tongues. All right, so this is the answering this one question, and I wonder if I've said enough about it yet. But let me just kind of stress this to finish up this first question: what is being compared? By just noting the word "in part" now, to really this kind of focuses it, right? And I think we can easily say what he's comparing then more refined way. He's comparing love and its permanence with knowledge in its incompleteness. Right? The impart word. Look at how many times that occurs. Four times. Verse 9a, we know in part. Verse 9b, we prophesy in part. In other words, I don't think he's saying we partly prophesy, like I have half a gift of prophecy, right? The product of our prophesying gives partial information, like we just talked in verse 8. That's partial. the impart, in verse 10, will pass away. He even makes it like into a noun, puts an article in front of it. The impart. You know, we know impart. The impart will pass away. And then verse 12, I know impart. 12b there. Now I know impart. It's this now and not yet about knowledge. And it's interesting, you have this aspect about knowledge. I know impart. And that fact that our knowledge, even by the gifts of the Spirit, in these unique and miraculous ways, through tongues and prophesying, the product that gives us knowledge of that type, even with all of saying all of that, it's partial. It's incomplete. And Paul is emphasizing then the permanence of love over against that incompleteness of knowledge. And so knowledge is going to go through a change. So let me, in a way that love doesn't, with love's abiding quality. So with that, I think I've more or less answered that question. I hope so. I feel like I'm all over the place. I hope we're getting you at least into the same general ballpark here. Here's my second question. What do the words when the that which is perfect comes refer to? So in verse 10, Paul says, but when the perfect comes, the in part, the partial, will pass away. What is he referring to about when the perfect comes? Now, you know, I think that you have to just kind of get a feel for that, that the big picture here when Paul says we're going to see face to face. And you have to say he's talking about all that's associated with the state of things at the coming of Christ, when we shall see face to face. And I would say, we shall see him face to face. And that has to be where we're at. Now, Edwards, you can look at Edwards, and I give you the references here. Edwards kind of does the theology, and he's a cessationist on the gifts issue here. And he explains that there's different senses in which the perfect comes. But one thing that he says at the end of his discussion, which is just in keeping with what I'm saying, I'll quote this. He simply says this. What Paul says, he still says that these words about seeing face to face are most agreeable. Edwards is saying they're most agreeable with the state of the church in heaven. So in case you're thinking about the debate over do the gifts cease, do the gifts continue, what they call continuationism or cessationism, if you're thinking in that vein, there have been different ways that people view the when the perfect comes. Edwards was a cessationist. He didn't believe that these gifts go on beyond the early apostolic church. But he says, and I think we have to agree, the real most important point that's being made as to the when here is at the coming of Christ. That is, this is most agreeable to the state of heaven, the state of affairs in heaven. So the words when the perfect comes, those words refer to the coming of Christ, all that's associated with that perfect state of affairs at his coming. So a third question, what is it that will pass away when the perfect comes? Now, I've biased that question already tremendously. See what I'm saying? There isn't any way that we're going to get here information as to when did the gifts cease? Did they cease at the time of the apostles, or do they cease at the second coming of Christ? Can't get that information here. What's going to cease when the perfect comes? Partial knowledge. Knowing in part. The gift, the product of tongue speech, the product of prophesying, and which we now have in Scripture, that product, even all the knowledge that we have, even by revelation from God, the partial, that is going to cease when Christ comes. That's going to take on, the partial is going to cease being partial, and it's going to move on into the fullness. Now, what implications can be then stated? Let me just note a couple of implications answering this question. Number one, for the cessation continuationism debate, briefly, but just a little comment on that because it's kind of so important in this connection. The passage cannot be appealed to in defense of cessation or in defense of continuation. Either one, I guess I've already said that. Second, as to abuses, we can make an implication. even not only were these gifts abused at Corinth, we know that's kind of, you can pick that up throughout the book, knowledge was also abused in the Corinthian context, as it was in the early church. There's a number of ways in which knowledge is given an undue place. And what Paul does here, in the backdrop, he has some little references to the gifts, but in the foreground, what he's doing is he's putting knowledge in its place in relationship to love in a way that he hasn't, he sort of hinted at, but he hasn't really done yet in this chapter. So it has been abused. And what he does, third implication, he develops the radical superiority of love over knowledge. And I think this is radically developed. There's a superb quality to love. See, love has its eternality, its abiding character, both now and in the not yet. In other words, it's eternal. And he has this partial, he's comparing it with our experience of knowing here on this earth, and it's partial. It's incomplete. Love has this superiority over it, and therefore love must be what we gravitate to with the greatest attention and priority. And I'll say some things about, about what that ultimately means in a minute and some concluding remarks. And finally, how is the promise of glory described in this context? I think even though, the promise of glory, just think about that for a minute, that way of stating the question. Even though Paul is about the task of showing the inferiority, the relative inferiority of knowledge to love, when he develops that inferiority of knowledge, you actually have in there in the now and not yet of knowledge this amazing look at what's to come. And that's those illustrations we said earlier about the child. It's the difference between being a child and becoming an adult, right? As a child, I thought a certain way, I understood a certain way, I reasoned as a certain way. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. What is that like? Well, that's just saying how partial knowledge is going to become full knowledge. The mirror illustration is marvelous in this section. It sounds like he says, he uses the preposition gives you the idea of how it would be when you look in a mirror, and probably in those days, the not having the benefit of the caliber of mirrors that we have today, you look through a mirror dimly. Does that language through? When you look into a mirror, it's like you're looking through something and you see the figure back in there, right? You look through the mirror and see this figure. So it's at least that's maybe one of the ways that you experience looking in a mirror. We see, but it's dim, dark. We now are not our knowing is like that, right? It's you see the things that God has revealed, but we see them like we're looking through this mirror, and things are dim and dark. And it's actually the word dimly there is actually the word. It sounds if you said the Greek word, it sounds like the English word enigma. It's practically the same word, enigma. We see through a mirror enigmatically. This just transliterated what he says almost. It's foggy, ambiguous, it's unclear. I mean, it's not a, I think the idea is it's accenting this, the nature of the incompleteness of it. That it's not, it doesn't have all that we're going to have yet in the future. So it's colored by our sin and our struggle, as well as the nature of what's been given itself. So we have the revelation itself is incomplete, and we're very frail in our grasp of it. We're like children, right? So think of the greatest people, an Einstein, or however great you think your knowledge is, right? However great you understand your domain, it's childish. Right? We have this as sort of humbling, right? We have to say our knowledge is childish. But not, childlike knowledge isn't untrue, necessarily. Sometimes it is, but childlike knowledge can be very straightforward. You remember, out of the mouth of babes, It may be very straightforward. Sometimes they capture things They're like blunt and narrow to the point. It's incomplete. And it can be very foggy. But it also can be very straightforward. But our knowledge is childlike. It's seeing through a mirror and dim. But look at the promise of glory. We will see face to face. And that has to reflect then the dimness is removed and it's like in the brightness of the day. Instead of looking in a mirror that's not a real good caliber mirror and seeing figures in that way incompletely, now we're going to see face to face in the full brightness of the day and know as we have been known. I don't know how to fill all that out except to say that's sort of a like hints of glory. Even though he puts knowledge in this inferior place with respect to the eternal abiding character of love, in that he still tells us in the now not yet of knowledge that we're heading for a glory of which the half has not been told us. And so we have promise again, promise out in front of us, the promise of glory. All right, let me just mention some things in conclusion, looking kind of now with those facts in mind. Just kind of think about this whole picture now. We know what he's comparing, right? And let's try to think that in relation to the whole chapter and a couple of things. Number one, we are encouraged by this chapter to learn. I just want to say that right up front. Knowledge is good. It's something that comes, it's hinted at, right? It comes by divine revelation. Much of it is what we have in Scripture by divine revelation. I mean, knowledge is good. Granted, Paul is concerned about exaggeration and distortion. And there's misconstruing of the place of knowledge. But learning and knowledge is good. Remember how he had said it. We're going to learn all things of the gospel. That means we're directed by Christ to all the words of the Old Testament, all the words of the New Testament. We are directed to the truth. Love rejoices in the truth. So the part of the permanence of love in relationship to the inferiority of knowledge is not to give us the impression that knowing is something that we should put out the back door and not bother with. This whole chapter gives us a balance about it. Knowledge has an inferiority to love. But knowledge is a good. It's a great good. It's something delightful. It's something in which love rejoices. So knowledge is not thrown out the door. Second, we have noted earlier, and I'll just mention it again, knowledge is for doing. This is the kind of the rubber meets the road part about Christianity, right? Learning the scriptures. Knowing, it's very important. Know theology, know the commandments, know the whole picture. Study and learn, be good students of the word. As a Christian, every Christian has that responsibility. But it's not just to know, right? Not just to have the head filled with a lot of information. Knowing is for doing. Love rejoices in the truth. In order to obey it, it seeks after Christ in seeking all things of Scripture, and it seeks Him in order to obey Him. So that's the great emphasis that we want to emphasize here, or stress here, on truthful, right doing. Remember, just that contrast, love doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing, but it rejoices in the truth. And so it has this accent on truthful, right doing. That's very important in the love chapter. So knowledge isn't put out to left field. But the way knowledge is to work, it must be pursued for obedience. That has to drive us. That's what must drive us to learn. That has to be what drives us in our learning. And any theology that doesn't have that as its driving point is misconstrued. It's out of balance in what Paul is developing in chapters like this and other places in Scripture. And finally, then, to make this last point, the bottom line is that knowledge must be subordinated to love. I mean, what's most important? See, when you think about doing, Knowledge is for doing. In other words, knowledge is for loving God and loving your neighbor. That's what knowing is for. Now see, this is a part that I think, you know, we have to really get our hands around this. This is very important. Just saying that knowledge is for doing in another way. But the point is that all knowing must be subordinated to love. It must be like under the rule of love. Love must rule. Love rules the pursuit of knowledge. Love is to rule the use of knowledge. Now, it doesn't matter what field it is. Learning God's knowledge and self-revelation and creation, learning it in Scripture, whatever we're doing, so it doesn't matter what our walk in life is, no matter what it is that we learn how to use a certain tool to do a certain job. Love, this chapter emphasizes, that you learn that under submission to love. In other words, it's like, to use the computer thing, it's like a window, the main window that you have to open up, in which everything else must be placed, is love. And all the windows of knowledge, I guess we'd say, all the other windows that we'd open up, you open up inside of that window. Remember, without that window, everything else is nothing. You're nothing. Without love, there is no meaning, there is no significance, there is no value in life. It's just saying, you see, without Christ, your life is empty and meaningless and has no value and no significance. That's all it's saying. You see, it's saying Christ must rule. When Paul says love must rule, when he puts love as that which has the dominant quality in comparison with partial knowledge. So we pursue knowing, we pursue learning. But we pursue it in order to serve our Lord. I think that's why I wanted to refer to, this is the connection where I wanted to refer to Psalm 119. So let me do that as a kind of some nailing this a little bit, just to highlight what I read earlier. And if you want to look at the Psalm or listen to some of these emphases here, and I'm not going to read the whole Psalm this time, but, just note the different things that are here. Law, precepts, God's commandments, and what delight the psalmist has in them and everything. But look at here's what I want to stress. The humble, this is where I think this chapter of 1 Corinthians 13 should bring us, to a humbleness. A humble petition. And the accent I want to place right now as I highlight things is listen to the psalmist's prayer. How he prays, the various things that he prays in here. And under one heading, I'll just give the prayer, Lord, incline my heart to you, to your law, to your commandments, to your precepts, to your testimonies, to your word. Just with that one in mind, let me highlight some of these. Just note, in Psalm 119, I had read earlier, starting at verse 25. And just note in verse 26, just the teach me. This is a prayer, a constant prayer. Lord, teach me. I'm a child, Lord. I'm a child in understanding. And I'm on this way. Teach me, O Lord. I acknowledge this. Make me understand the way of your precepts. I mean, he wants to learn God's precepts. Right? That's verse 27. Just look down at verse 32. I love this phrase, which I wonder if Watson the Puritan got this from the Hebrew before the ESV ever came out, since he used probably something like the Geneva Bible translation or an earlier version of the King James. But here it says, I will run in the way of your commandments. When you enlarge my heart. It's like his prayer to teach me and to let me in on these things and fill my heart with these things and enlarge my heart and incline my heart, etc. Then what will I do? What's the goal of my learning? To run. Run in the way of your commandments. The speedy obedience, right? Not, I'm not going to sit around and wait and dog my feet, you know, and just, you know, be slow about it. But running to obey, right? Teach me, verse 33. Give me, this should be our prayer, our humble prayer. Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things confirm to your servant your promise. So this is just a wonderful comparison verse, it seems to me, with what we're doing here in 1 Corinthians 13. And I guess I just want to close by just saying this, that we are to grow in knowledge. Let me just kind of put it together in this last sentence. We are to grow in knowledge, but we are to do so. And this is critical. This I want to emphasize. We are to do so for the sake of love, for the sake of Christ. Right? And because of Him, for the sake of others. You can see the point of loving. This is Christian, Christ-like love. That's the permanence of love that we're to pursue now on the way in relation to knowing. So may the Lord bless us to that great end. Let's bow for prayer.